Hi, my name is Amit Doshi.
And I'm David Rissman.
And we are talking about problem-based learning at Georgia Tech. What qualifies us to talk about problem-based learning at Georgia Tech?
Well, Amit, not a whole lot qualifies us to talk about problem-based learning at Georgia Tech, but we are in this graduate companion course. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about it.
We do have some qualification. So, well, we'll put the qualifications aside for now and just go with the flow.
Okay, that sounds good. We'll talk a little bit about...
We'll ask the audience to assume some expertise here.
Maybe a false assumption, but
well,
that's okay.
You're right, David. We've been enrolled in this wonderful graduate course for the last semester about problem-based learning. It's a companion course to an undergraduate course. So we've got the graduate course as a companion course to an undergraduate course. Is that right?
So I guess the best way to explain it is to talk about what the undergraduate course is doing, and then we can talk about what our role in that is and what our role in the future is going to be. So the undergraduate course is essentially, there are small groups and then a graduate student who is facilitating these groups. And these groups are led to come up with a congressional policy proposal on cutting edge issues in bioethics. And we've dealt with some really interesting topics this semester.
Yeah, and this semester the topics have really been about neuroethics, focusing on issues related to the brain and technologies that relate to the brain. There's some pretty amazing things that we've been talking about, very science fiction-y.
Absolutely. You know, the first problem that they dealt with was involving brain-machine interfaces and their use in the military. And, you know, there's technology out there that allows individuals on the battlefield to read each other's minds so they won't let the enemy know what's going on. And so the students were asked to come up with a policy proposal on these various technologies that are being used in the military that involve actually going into the mind. And that's where our graduate class comes in, is we are monitoring this course so we can see what's been working, what hasn't been working. We've been working together to write the problems and
the rubrics.
And the rubrics, and you know, we're doing a lot of the gradings. And we're doing this so next semester we are qualified to actually facilitate one of these small groups ourselves.
That's right. And this is very different, I think, than what the traditional engineering curriculum requires of students, right? I'm thinking back to my own college experience where I'd say 90%+ of the courses I took, and David, things may have changed since I was in school. You're a young gun. You probably have had some more problem-based learning courses. But when I was in school, you show up, the sage on the stage imparts their knowledge to you, take notes dutifully, and then you spit it out on the exam. And that was really the extent of the vast majority of the classes that I took.
And truthfully, it was the extent of the vast majority of mine. And, you know, we live in an age where access to almost any information is available at your fingertips. And so being able to learn something and then regurgitate it on the test is not a particularly practical skill at this point, is it?
So by your fingertips, you mean talking to your local librarian. That's what you're referring to, right? I hope so.
I wish that was the case, Amit, for your sake and for your job security. But you know, with Google, any basic undergraduate information is going to be available online. And, you know, so employers aren't looking for students who have an understanding of information. They're looking for students who are capable of analyzing information or of applying information and working in groups. And this is where PBL stands apart from the typical curriculum.
That's right. Applying information in the service of solving complex, and here comes a lingo alert, fractious problems, right?
And that's what we're particularly focused on. You know, in the area of ethics, there are issues that can draw people to a standstill because they're so engulfed in ideology. And so a lot of what we're doing, a lot of the problems that we're dealing with are problems that are going to be engulfed in ideology. And we're forcing the students to consider, you know, all sides of a problem and to be able to see these ideological frameworks and to be able to look past them to come up with solutions that don't necessarily fall in either or that can involve a consensus.
That's right. Fractious problem navigation. That's the term that's been tossed about in problem-based learning. So fractious. So this is a little bit of data of dictionary definitions for you. Fractious problem navigation, FPN, PBL, problem-based learning, GT, Georgia Tech. Any others?
GSU Law. GSU. Georgia State Law, and I'm just going to give a plug because, you know, I'm in school there.
There you go. So you have your definitions, and hopefully that will help make the rest of the podcast a little easier to listen to. So, you know, this might be an appropriate moment for Dr. Wendy Neustetter, who really started problem-based learning at Georgia Tech, to talk a little bit about her process, about what she did to start this culture of problem-based learning in an engineering, biomedical engineering course right here at Georgia Tech. So let's take a moment and listen to Dr. Neustetter, and then we'll be back with more.
I like to think of what we've been doing in biomedical engineering as problem-driven learning, which is moving beyond the initial notion of PBL, which came from medicine, to a variety of models of how you would do this, because you kind of have to, you have to adjust to what you're teaching. And so if you're teaching a hardcore engineering course in principles of conservation, mass energy balance, versus a course in ethics, you have to continue to tweak and adjust a pedagogy that is appropriate. So I believe that I was very lucky. I sat down with faculty who were starting a new department and had no curricula. I sat down with a group of faculty in a discipline where there were no textbooks, thank God. And so they had no choice but to do something innovative. And I also sat down with a faculty that said, we don't want to recreate ourselves, which is a very unique perspective to take as an engineer. And they said, we put a problem on the table. We want to create true innovative thinkers and problem solvers who are able to bridge the gap between the biosciences and engineering. And that was our charge. That was our problem. And the only way I could think of from a cognitive perspective, although computer science is doing it differently with threads, you know, they're taking thread in this, and not even integration. There's no integration in their curriculum in threads, except maybe capstone design. But I think if you look at their capstone design, there's no integration there. I thought integration was a really interesting and significant cognitive challenge, because thinking like an engineer and thinking like a scientist are very different, okay? In fact, in some ways, they could even be thought of as oppositional. One is trying to go to detail, intense detail, and engineers like to idealize and extract and model from very simplified elements. So, like, they're oppositional. So we've got a problem here. So we developed our curriculum based on problem-based learning. We had the opportunity to actually create spaces in a building. It was very scary because we were committing more than 50% of our space to PBL rooms. We hadn't actually even figured out how to do it yet. So there was, on my part, a lot of nail-biting. Over the years, we've developed. So this semester in that course, there are 220 students. That's scaling en masse, okay? And everyone at the beginning said, you're never going to be able to scale this. You'll never be able to scale this. Well, I think we scaled to 220. That's not bad. We can handle that. So we have 26 teams this semester. What we've done that's innovative this semester, we now have undergraduate facilitators. These are students who've gone through a whole curriculum experiencing PBL. Now they're seniors, and they're actually paired with a faculty postdoc or grad student in kind of tag teams. So that's something novel we're doing. One thing we discovered to respond to something you said, we discovered over the years that if you can create a core problem that is designed to actually introduce students to a particular way of thinking in that discipline, you can put skins on it. So we have core problems that have three, we have three core problems, but we can put a different skin on them every single semester. So to give you an example of that, the final problem the students do is computational mathematical modeling of some kind of system. So it's often some kind of disease. So this semester, guess what it is? It's zombies. And we created a problem where there's been a virus that just came out of the Yerkes Primate Center that is infecting people over at Emory, and they're turning into zombies that can live and eat, live for 8 days, and they try to run people down and eat them. And Georgia Tech is trying to prepare so for what they're going to do. And so the way they have to address this problem is they have to come up with a baseline mathematical model of infection, and then if they want to do predator prey, because these things do run people down. And then they have to actually try scenarios mathematically to figure out what might be the best. Should it be a vaccine? Should we have machine guns on the border? Whatever you want to do. But anyway, another semester could be H1N1. Another semester was, should they be able to publish an article in Science Magazine or not, coming up with policy decisions based on mathematical and computational modeling. So if any of you are fooling around with this, I really urge you to try to figure out what a core problem would be that you can always put new skins on. So then what happens is the students are, every semester is different, and if you have facilitators doing it over and over again, you don't get bored either. So you have new problems every semester.
We just heard from Wendy Neustetter, professor in biomedical engineering, about her approach to problem-based learning at Georgia Tech. She really started the ball rolling here, and it's important to note that here at Georgia Tech, all biomedical engineering first-year students are required to take a problem-based learning class. So they they get this at a really early stage.
And it's been spread throughout campus. And let's talk about why we do this and what problem-based learning offers that something else doesn't. Imagine you are a business major and you've learned all your mathematics, you take all your business courses and you understand some basics about business. And you get into your first day on the job and you're put in a group of five and you're asked to come up with a reason why Ford should buy Honda. Well, nothing has prepared you to actually do any real analysis. You understand how much, say, Ford could buy Honda for. You understand that Honda also sells cars. But you don't really know what to do with that book knowledge. And with, a downturn in the economy, a lot of employers relied on training programs to prepare students to go from the academic world to the real world. But they've been cutting the training programs, and so the burden is lying very heavily on the schools. And if all you have is the book knowledge, you will really struggle in your first week, year, 2-3 years actually in a field. And I mean, the same would be true in engineering or many other disciplines.
One can hypothesize what the students feel like that have been through this process, and the anecdotes are very encouraging. Anecdotally, students appreciate the fact that this is a more engaging style of learning. They're not just sitting kind of audience style listening to a lecture for 50 minutes or an hour and a half. They're actually participating and creating knowledge. And what's really exciting is there are students at the undergraduate level that are solving such fractious problems. There's a potential, and I think there's some history to this, of having an impact on the real-world policy decision-making process. That's what's really exciting. Imagine a group of students who come up with a very airtight, robust policy analysis and potential solution architecture for some of these fractious problems. Let's take the ethical dilemma of whether or not K-12 schools should allow tackle football. And this is a problem that's fraught. It's certainly on the headlines right now. If students as a group came up with a solution architecture that made sense and the right people saw it, that could lead to some very interesting possibilities for these undergrads, right?
Right. And for a problem like that or any problem that has a lot of angles and will have a lot of controversy, you need to be able to look at multiple angles. You need to be able to look at multiple perspectives. You need to be able to put them all together and come up with a solution. And let's be honest, undergraduates will oftentimes go through a course by not paying a whole lot of attention in class, studying a little bit at home, and then cramming before the exam. Well, when you're in a problem-based learning environment, you're forced into a room with four or five other people. You're talking about all the different issues in a problem that's not only interesting, but ethically fraught. And you're forced to engage, because if you don't engage, you're dragging down the entire group. And you're forced to consider all sorts of different angles in a civil way, because you're working with other people who have different opinions than you. And each step of the way, you're not just cramming at the end. You're learning constantly, and you're developing perspectives constantly. And this is what you would be doing in a leadership role, in a real role in industry. And so PBL, it does a lot of things. It considers different perspectives. It also forces students to be able to be actively engaged, and it forces students to be able to really, really understand a subject in a way that they wouldn't by just cramming at the end of a class.
So this is one type of flipped classroom concept. The flipped classroom is another jargony thing that's been tossed about the last few years. It's the idea that you absorb the necessary facts, data, information outside of the classroom, and you take that valuable face-to-face time and you do something productive with it. Just as when you're in the workplace, you don't want to spend a meeting having everyone read their email. But that's kind of like what's going on, in a sense. You know, in the classroom there's a one-way kind of delivery of information that could be done outside the classroom, and PBL and other flipped classroom models, that precious time is being used more wisely. So this might be a good time to talk about how this actually works. What's the infrastructure? How does the facilitation model work? How can this be scaled? And how do you build a community around problem-based learning? And to help us answer this question is Dr. Michael Hoffman from the School of Public Policy. Recently, there was a convocation of faculty at Georgia Tech who had worked in problem-based learning. Dr. Neustetter was there. Dr. Hoffman gave his thoughts. A number of professors from around campus and graduate students who had been facilitators shared their ideas. So this is Dr. Hoffman talking about creating an infrastructure and building a community. So let's listen to him.
We need to establish an infrastructure that is supportive for problem-based learning. So that is our main challenge. And the question is, do we really need new and additional resources, or can we develop ideas based on your expertise to optimize the possibilities of problem-based learning in a way that it can be achieved cost-efficiently? And that means basically with the numbers of TAs that we have right now available for undergraduate education. There are many who are interested in problem-based learning across campus, not only in our school, across campus. So it is also important to spread the word so that we get people coming together in this community. So creating an infrastructure, but also creating a community that develops this infrastructure and provides a forum to discuss all the issues related to problem-based learning.
And we're back. That was Dr. Michael Hoffman from the School of Public Policy talking about how to create a community of people interested in problem-based learning. And I think they have a good start. They just certainly have a good foundation of some pioneers in this area right here at Georgia Tech. Now, David, you are a law student at Georgia State Law. How is problem-based learning been applied in the legal area or in the law school area?
Well, it unfortunately hasn't yet. And you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot in this course, there are two reports out there, the McCrae report and the Carnegie report, and they surveyed lawyers across the field asking what they believe the biggest gap in legal education is. And you know, I think I had touched on it before, where a lot of professional firms that had training when bringing in first-year associates, particularly in law, to help prepare them for the practice of law, because the law school experience is based on the Socratic method. So the teacher, you know, calls on you and asks you to analyze the case, and there's certainly a level of analysis, but you're still working on a very individualized level. Your grade is based on your individual performance. And in the practice of law, as in many professions, it's not about your individual performance, although to some extent it is. It's about results and the results that you can achieve in a team. And problem-based learning really tests your ability to work in a team, because you can be brilliant and you can be egotistical and antisocial, and you're not capable of working in a team. Thus, you're not capable of producing results. And the employer doesn't care about your ego. They care about your results. And so in law, where law firms as due to the economy, have gotten rid of a lot of their formal training. You know, they're relying on the law schools to do this training. And the McRae Report and the Carnegie Report essentially said that first-year lawyers are useless and a liability for the firm. And so I believe truly that in law school and in other professional schools, that problem-based learning can really help bridge that gap, help get you to practice, help you understand being results-oriented and being team-oriented and dealing with problems from a lot of different angles, in dealing with problems with a lot of different perspectives, whereas in an individualized environment, you're just not doing that.
So perhaps this is a transformation in the way humans do research and the way humans work. You know, for a long time, we worked individually. There's a Newton underneath the apple tree. You know, there's this long history of scientists, engineers, scholars working in very small, working solo, and that doing great things was essentially a solo endeavor. And now it's big teams. I mean, think about any major advance in biomedicine. It's a big team. I see some of these papers that are published, especially in medicine, but certainly in other fields, where there's, you know, a number of co-PIs, and then there is a list of 12, 13, 15 co-authors, 20 co-authors on one paper.
And it goes back to the change in skill sets. Because in the time of Newton, in the time, 100 years ago, what made you capable was your knowledge, was how much you knew on a subject, not your ability to analyze it necessarily. Obviously that played a part. But in an age where we're sharing knowledge and knowledge is so accessible and so rapid, it's your ability to collaborate. It's your ability to take that knowledge and take other people's perspective on that knowledge and turn it into something new. You know, a lot of patents come from the combining of old technologies. You know, we're building on our own knowledge base and everything's moving so fast. So it's your ability to keep pace. It's your ability to work with others. And it's not just your ability to be a subject matter expert, where that alone at one point could have taken you far.
So you can still be a subject matter expert and have value, but it really needs to be in a collaborative manner. And it needs to be a kind of a team. A field goal kicker is useless without the person that snaps the ball, the person that holds the ball, and the offensive line that's blocking for him, right?
Right. And, you know, in football, it's not the quarterback who wins the game. It's not the offensive lineman who wins the game. It's not the coach who wins the game. It's the team that wins the game. And you know, in industry, it's the company that wins the game. It's all of the individuals as a collective who have worked together towards this project, and they share in the victory. And, you know, we need to be able to get students who are going into professions to be able to share in the victory and not believe that it's all about them. Because those are the people who will fail no matter how smart, no matter how much they know about a subject. They will not be capable of working in the team environment that today's standards really require.
So problem-based learning perhaps reflects a transformation in human relations. And maybe this has been to some degree caused by advances in technology, but certainly it's happening in the workplace, and students are being trained at the undergraduate and the graduate level to work. It's an apprenticeship program. That's essentially what's going on. You know, it's interesting, during the convocation, this problem-based learning convocation that took place here at Georgia Tech, Dr. Bob Kirkman talked about the apprenticeship model of his problem-based learning course, and he made a great analogy with making a horseshoe. So let's hear what Dr. Kirkman had to say about his experience.
Think of this as an apprenticeship. You know, if you're an apprentice blacksmith, the first horseshoe you make isn't going to be very good. And maybe the third time out, you'll get one that actually looks like a horseshoe. That's all I'm asking you to do in this course, is get one that looks horseshoe-like. You can refine the rest later. So this allowed me to do, what worked well, is it forced me to really think about what it means to teach practical ethics. So I really refined that approach to ethics itself and to teaching ethics. And so what am I expecting of students cognitively? And one of the things is, one of the great truths for me in I said, now I'm version 3.0, I joke, of my problem-based learning approach. Around version 2.3, I started to let go of the idea that what I need to do is have my students write arguments. Because if I ask them to write arguments, they front-load their opinion, and then they rig the argument to support their opinion. So what I tell them to do is that this is not about opinion, this is about considered judgment. And in fact, defer judgment until after the course is over. All I'm interested in is the consideration part. So what do you take into account? So I often basically say, I'm asking you to show your work on an essay. Don't write the essay, don't hand the essay, just show your work. Show me all the different considerations you might take into account before you make your decision. So this actually really helped me in thinking about how I approach ethics, how I approach teaching, and what I expect of students.
That was Dr. Bob Kirkman talking about the apprenticeship approach that he tries to instill within his students and in his problem-based learning course. So I should probably come clean that, and I'm not sure if I mentioned this before, but not only am I enrolled as a graduate student in this problem-based learning companion course, but I'm also a librarian, a research librarian right here at Georgia Tech. And I spent a lot of time helping the students in School of Economics navigate this world of exploding information and try to find the best resources, the most valuable content in a quick and efficient way, and really try to teach them how to do that as well. And that's a big part of this. The problems that students are being asked to solve require a foundational knowledge. And they also require that they acquire that foundational knowledge in a very efficient, short amount of time. So let's talk about the neuroethics class, for example. They have to learn a lot of pretty important, complicated, complex concepts in what? Just a matter of weeks, right?
Yeah, it's about 5 weeks, and then they need to be able to apply them in a pretty rapid manner in that group setting. And so it really is, as we were talking about before, the ability to take subject matter and really do deep analysis and consider multiple perspectives. And they have to do this in a very accelerated period of time in at least our class. And I think it's even more intense in the biomedical engineering class. And I know that they do this in a statistical analysis class
and
as well.
There's an aerospace engineering problem-based learning. So, yeah, how do you do that? How do you create a foundational set of knowledge for to solve a problem in just a matter of weeks or months?
I have a feeling you're going to say libraries.
It's capital L library. So I was so thrilled to be invited into this course when Dr. Barry and I talked about the library and how it might fit. So there's been a librarian embedded with the undergraduate course, Chris Doty. He is a research librarian at Georgia Tech, and he's been taking a passive approach in the sense that he's not, as students are working on their problems in class, he's not tapping them on the shoulder saying that you did that wrong or where'd you get that source, but rather he's observing, and then at certain times he will. There'll be opportunities for students to ask him questions, and then he'll also do some teaching as well in the class.
Well, and let's be clear as to why some of that teaching needs to occur. What are undergraduates' favorite source of information?
I'm going to say the research databases that are available through the library website, but I know I'm going to be wrong.
I'm going to say Google.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to say that you're probably right.
And I'm going to say that they look at the very first thing that pops up. Maybe Wikipedia, they read it and they take it at face value. So why is that a problem to me?
So the reason that's a problem is I like to think of the New Yorker cartoon that's been widely cited by many people. And that's this picture of two dogs. One of the dogs is on the internet and he says to the other dog, you know, on the internet, nobody knows I'm a dog. And there's a certain truth to that because it's in cyberspace. It's very easy to edit information and post it unvetted in a variety of different forums, and in a innumerable ways. So it's, you know, Wikipedia is a great example. Wikipedia is really great on some facts that I think would be commonly accepted. Things like population. And it's also really great on topics that are brand new, like these areas of discourse that are just emerging. And maybe there hasn't been anything in the peer-reviewed literature about it. But when you're talking about ethical fractious problems, when you're talking about FPN, fractious problem navigation, some of these sites are not optimal. Really, what students need to have is a foundational knowledge about who are the greats in this field, what are the great papers, the seminal works in this field. And the way they find that is by talking to a librarian who can teach them how to use a controlled vocabulary to do some subject searching through our databases. Most people in academia realize that you can't get the best information for free always. In fact, it's sometimes rare to find the best information in a field for free out on the free internet. It's often behind paywalls. And those paywalls are usually at research libraries, where libraries have paid for this content so the rest of the university can get access to it.
Right. So the students, I guess you're saying that they need you as a resource to be able to look past just the kind of the surface level, maybe even inaccurate information, to be able to really get to what matters. And I guess there's so much information out there, oftentimes contradictory, that
That's
without
true.
The help of somebody who really understands information itself, how are they able to tell the difference? And what else is the library doing to kind of help with not only the research, but with problem-based learning altogether?
So that's a really great segue to what is so exciting about what's happening at Georgia Tech Library. The library is in the midst of a physical transformation, but also I'd say a kind of transformation of its role on campus. For the last decade or so, we've been creating these spaces that allow students to collaborate using whiteboards, lots of movable furniture, and it's been replicated to some degree in the Undergraduate Learning Commons, which is attached to the library. Lots of whiteboards everywhere, lots of movable furniture, round tables, LCD screens in many classrooms, just the ideal environment for groups to get together and work on any kind of collaborative project. And the library is kind of in a place where we want to move some of these older print collections off-site and use that space that really isn't getting used in an efficient way for these types of flexible, collaborative, problem-based learning workspaces.
When you say you want to move some of the older collections off-site, are you talking about a library with no books?
A library with no books. But so a library has never been about books. For the last 50 to 100 years or so, our brand has been the book, just because libraries have built these large buildings, often windowless, because books don't like windows. And we've done somewhat of a disservice to ourselves, because now that so much is available electronically, those books aren't being checked out as much. They're taking up a lot of space. But libraries have never been about books. You'll remember, David, I'm sure, as a scholar of the Library of Alexandria, that
that's an accurate description of me, certainly.
That's where scholars from all over the world used to go to interact not only with the scrolls, but with each other. So this was a kind of a multidisciplinary learning commons for the world. That's what libraries have been doing.
So you feel like libraries in many ways have lost their purpose, and that you and Georgia Tech as a whole are kind of bringing back that original purpose. And the books aren't going to be completely inaccessible, is that
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's going to enhance. We're planning a collaboration with Emory Libraries, and so now Georgia Tech faculty and students will have even greater access to Emory's library collection. Not only that, now I feel like a used car salesman, but not only that, but these books that are in the library currently are in some conditions that are not optimal for organic materials. Things like mold ruin a collection. And in these facilities where we're planning to jointly store books with Emory, books will last for 300 years. Humidity's controlled, temperature's controlled, there's no water leaks. You know, these are airtight types of facilities. So it's good for the books. It's good for our new learning approaches, our new pedagogies. And it's exciting for the library. We're kind of going, we're coming full circle back to the Library of Alexandria. I think we're doing something that's going to be transformational and change the world. I'm really excited about it. And we're the first. I think a lot of other libraries are going to follow suit. And one of those things is creating spaces for problem-based learning and also creating resources to support problem-based learning. Things like the research guide. We have to talk about the research guide. So
my favorite subject is the research guide.
Mary Axford, the subject librarian for public policy, our beloved Mary Axford, put together a research guide to help students navigate this morass of information about neuroethics. And it, you know, linked to the most recent information. It linked to some of those seminal works that we were talking about. And it helps students find out what's important quickly and also what's most accurate and most valuable that you wouldn't get from just a normal Google search.
Absolutely. And you know, I think that with when we've talked about how broad and how much information there is out there and how much of it is inaccurate, you know, the role of a librarian to be able to help facilitate the learning of a student by kind of almost acting as a filter is valuable. And, you know, Amit's been talking about how they're going to have all these learning spaces and there's going to be LCD screens. It's going to be very modern. It's really going
holograms.
To. Holograms.
The holodeck.
And, you know, I think that it's going to be a really great place for the students to be able to really get what they want out of school. And, you know, the truth is, you know, we were talking earlier, content alone, why come to school?
Yeah, content can be delivered in a variety of ways now, and primarily electronically, although we're learning about brain-to-brain transfer of information, so maybe that's the future.
Well, and that'll make the classroom even more mood if you can just download all the information. So, you know, and that's a big concern, I think, across many campuses, is that for content delivery, it's becoming less and less relevant for students to show up to class. They can go on, they can do an online class, they can see their professor, they can interact with their professor, they can even interact with other students. So what makes a physical university really competitive? And if you've ever been on Georgia Tech's campus, it's gorgeous, but that's not enough. And so, you know, I think problem-based learning, and this school is on the cutting edge of it, but I believe that you're going to see schools across the country start to implement it, because it's really one of the ways for a school to remain competitive, because problem-based learning and being able to work in groups and being able to have these areas that are designated to it and being able to have these librarians who are committed to being able to facilitate the experience, you can't get that on an internet course, and you never will be able to, no matter how much the technology changes.
I don't know. Never say never.
Well, the holograms may get us there.
Well, I think this is a good time to step back and maybe talk about, what are the outcomes of a problem-based learning course? What's the good and the bad? What are the challenges? But also, what have students gained from these types of experiences? And who better to help us through that than, of course, our professor, Roberta Berry, Dr. Roberta Berry, from the School of Public Policy. And she spoke very eloquently about her experience at the problem-based learning convocation. So let's listen to Dr. Berry.
We achieve some level of ethical competency with STEM students who, coming in, didn't think that this was a domain that was, you know, they thought it was outside their bailiwick, not something of concern to them beyond checking a box of humanities and ethics requirement. I think they got a sense of what ethics and policy are about. I think they took some ownership of the problems. I think to some extent they felt empowered coming from STEM disciplines to apply a cognitive model and a problem-solving approach to actually come up with reasoned, justified policy positions. And I think they learned a lot of PBL skills, which will be useful in life and work. They did learn some PBL skills and some of the practice problem navigational skills, looking at multiple perspectives, coming up with principles, thinking of predicted impacts. I won't go into the details, but it's a whole cognitive model based on work I had done, and with the help of Wendy Neustetter, operationalized in this
NSFE, ESE, PBL project we did. I think they learned a lot about the subject matter. They took deep dives into the subject matter to tackle the problems. We had a response to one of our classes, teams are where the magic happens. And so when students report on their experience, there is this sense of engagement and, you know, this is really cool. And it's neat to see what happens with multiple minds, with multiple perspectives are working on something. I think most facilitators, and we'll have an opportunity for those in the room to comment on this, found it fun and satisfying and learned a lot about a lot of things, including what the undergraduates learned.
That was Dr. Berry from the School of Public Policy talking about the challenges and the opportunities, some of the problem-based learning outcomes that she's experienced as a professor teaching PBL in the ethics environment, in the ethics and policy environment. So here we are at the end of our time, and I guess this is a good time to talk about some final thoughts about problem-based learning. What's been your experience with the class?
You know, when I've sat in on the classes, it's been really interesting because I remember in my undergraduate, particularly my freshman and sophomore year, I was really interested in my junior and senior, but I remember just not caring. And I remember being very checked out. I didn't sleep in class quite like I did in high school, but, I wasn't all there. And, you know, my experience in these classes, and it may be reflective partially of Georgia Tech students, but I think it's bigger than that. My experience in these classes has been these students are incredibly engaged, incredibly interested, and the facilitators are helping to keep them interested, and you're seeing them come to conclusions and utilize each other's knowledge in a way that the regular classroom doesn't. And you know, it's interesting seeing them kind of vibe off of each other, and oftentimes they won't have laptops out, and they'll talk about a subject, and they'll go around the room, and it's amazing the information that five minds, when they're just casually talking, can put together. And so I think that problem-based learning is really an amazing, although challenging, way to learn a subject and really master a subject that you just can't do in the regular classroom environment.
It's certainly not as fun. You know, it's interesting you mentioned the laptop thing, because one of the groups that I observed, they had a unspoken policy about laptops, and they realized that the laptop was kind of a crutch that people were hiding behind their laptops, and that it was hindering the conversation. And so as a group, they decided that, all right, we're not going to rely on our devices. And here we are in this the millennial generation kind of stepping back from the technology and just focusing on the human to human communication, sans technology. Imagine that in 2013.
Right, and obviously the technology remains a tool, but you know, technology can't analyze. Technology doesn't innovate, although you know maybe it will one day. But as of right now, we still rely on collaboration to really create innovation, which is what drives us forward. And problem-based learning is one of the best environments to foster that collaboration and innovation that is really required in order for us to move forward as a society.
I think I couldn't say it better than that, David. Well put. So that's the end of our short history and let's say our takeaways about problem-based learning based on our experiences as graduate students in a problem-based learning companion course here at Georgia Tech during the fall 2013 semester. Thank you for listening. And tell your friends about PBL at Georgia Tech.